smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Nana Amadankwa. Nana Amadankwa is a writer, editor, and journalist. She's the author of Willow Weep for Me, A Black Woman's Journey to Depression. How are you doing, Nana Ama?
I'm great. I'm doing really great. Can I correct your pronunciation of my name?
Is it Nana or Nana?
No, it's just Nanama.
Nanama.
Yeah.
Nanama.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what happened? Because my grandkids said Nana, I was saying, you know.
And then there's also a hyphen, so it confuses people, but it's just Nanama.
Nanama. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm going to have to work on that today.
No, you're not. You can also just say Nana if it's that.
Okay, I'll just say Nana. Okay.
That works. All right. You can call me either Nana or Ama or Nanama.
I've known you a long time, so I'm gonna talk about this because on a very serious note, I'm looking at name changes and self-identity, things of that sort. But let's look at what we have in terms of Willow Weep for Me. It came out in 1998.
Yes.
And you just had a reprint in 2023.
Yes.
And in the reprint, there's a new foreword by Andrew Solomon. Talk about Andrew Solomon's book, The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression, because that's an extremely important book.
Oh, it's a classic. It's a go-to. I think of Andrew's book and William Styron's book. Those are really the first two, other than my own, that I think of when I think of books that should be recommended by people who are suffering from depression. He just kind of, he looked at the whole world and how the world deals with depression. And he took it out of the American context, looked at it from other cultures. And it's just an incredible contribution to literature and to medicine.
You know, one of the things that Andrew Solomon talks about, and he talks about depression is the flaw in love. Can you expand on that?
I think you're going to have to ask Andrew to expand on that. I'm not so sure that I totally agree with that.
And why? Why do you not totally agree with that?
Depression is the flaw in love. Mm-hmm. I'm not so sure I agree that love, I think love is flawed, but I don't think that it's flawed by or with depression.
Okay.
I think it's flawed with our own human imperfections, but maybe it can be thought of as that, but I wouldn't say that it's, I wouldn't necessarily put it side by side, with love.
What about looking at, maybe I believe you might have said this, that depression is...
Oh, you froze.
Oh, okay. Am I moving now?
You're moving now.
Okay. My question was the whole thing about maybe depression being anger turned inward.
You know, I hear that, and it just sounds so pop psychology 1980s, to me. That depression is anger turned inward.
Right.
I think that we do have anger turned inward, but not everybody who has anger turned inward, experiences depression.
Right.
And then there are people who are very comfortable turning their anger outward that experience depression. So I'm not sure that that is a consistent sort of statement. I do, however, think that I think depression is a kind of suffering. Now, I think that depression, and I think this is one of the ways that we should start talking about it. Depression is many things, and there are many types of depression. There are people who nothing necessarily societally has happened that we can necessarily point to, but they experience depressive episodes. So one would imagine that it's biological for them. It's just some sort of biological issue. And then there are people who experience depression, and I think it's a normally adaptive response. Mm-hmm. You know, for many things, including racism, mm-hmm. I think it's a normally adaptive response to poverty.
Well, okay, I want to get into that, but I want to go back to something that you said in the joking way. You said, "Oh, that must have been something like the 1980s." But but I want to focus on the fact that
the sharper image in Paisley tie.
Right. But let me, your book came out in 1998, okay? And yes. Now we got like the 25th anniversary. What has happened in those, say, those 25 years that we have a different perspective, a different look at depression?
Oh my gosh, there's so much and so little that has happened at the same time. I'm glad you asked that question. I think that on what has happened positively, I think that people are speaking more about being depressed or suffering from depression. And I think that people talk more about being in therapy. And that's wonderful. You know, because the stigma is sort of, you know, being erased. However, I also think that on the receiving end, people really don't respond in a way that says that they understand what depression is. You know, whenever there's a public suicide, for instance, somebody high profile that commits suicide, I see on social media, and it always just sort of, you know, makes me sort of flinch for a moment. People will say, check on your friends, especially the strong ones. And I think, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. Because that tells me that you don't understand what clinical depression is. If you think that picking up a phone and checking on your strong friends is somehow going to do anything, you know.
Let me mention another narrative that comes in. You mentioned about celebrities. I find that there's a typical narrative that occurs when they find somebody who's like a mass shooter who commits, you know, atrocities in terms of going to a school or something. And then there's always this thing that is mental illness, you know, mm-hmm. And then there's always a thing that somebody was a loner in school or bully or something like that. But it always seems as if we want to look at not this person as an individual. We don't ever want to look at the conspiracy. Sometimes we just want to look at it as an individual. It's not racism or this or that. It's not a movement of far right people, but or left. But it's a whole thing in terms of this one individual has mental illness problems. And that's why they went out and shoot up a whole bunch of people.
Mm. Well, you know.
And that just seems like it hurts the whole thing if you're seriously working in terms of trying to deal with mental illness.
I think it does. But I also think that, you know, listen, it's not just mental illness. That's the issue with right. that example. It's also racism. You know, they're a lone wolf when they're white or they have mental illness. If they're any other color, then it's terrorism. It's some other reason. So I think that it's not just depression that, you know, takes a hit with that. I think it's also, I think it plays into all of our greatest fears. Mm-hmm. You know, people fear mental illness. They don't understand it. They fear it. And when you say that, you know, in their minds, it can lead you or it can prompt you to pick up a gun and just do a mass killing of some sort, that makes people fear that label, mentally ill, even more. Mm-hmm. You know, I also think that people, you know, people fear, that's what xenophobia is, people fear the other. And mm-hmm. so when, of course, you say that, you know, a white shooter is mentally ill, that's one thing. Then, you know, when you say it's a person of color and you say it is a jihadist or a whatever, that also plays into the fear of that other. So mm-hmm. I think it's more an issue of playing into our fears, but it works. Mm. You know, it works. I'm serious. It works because what it does is that it actually pushes us back in terms of that stigma. You know, mm-hmm. so whatever progress we make, it pushes us back. Because what people don't understand is that mental illness and physical illness are very similar. It's one body, you know, and there are people that are going to go through periods of physical illness. You know, you may have had the flu last week, or you may be diagnosed with MS or Parkinson's or something. And just as physical illnesses can be transitory, or they can be, you know, long term, so can mental illness. Just as people are born with physical illnesses and they deal with them the majority of their lives, so too mental illness. So anything that, you know, you can say about physical illness, that exists too with mental illness. But we, first of all, we make it sound as if it is just a condition.
Well, let's bring another word into the conversation that you might hear, and that's the word trauma and depression. Is there some kind of link
between trauma and depression?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I certainly think that somebody who's been through trauma has a proclivity toward depression. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I meant also earlier when I said that some depression, I believe, is a normal adaptive response. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, who faults somebody for dealing with depression if they've been sexually abused, if they have been traumatized in some way, if they've been raped, if they've been held up at gunpoint, if they've been the victim of, you know, or been involved with in a mass shooting. You know, I'm sure that, you know, people who deal with PTSD, which is another, falls also under the umbrella of a mental illness.
Let me ask you a couple of personal questions. I've known you a long time.
Okay. It's personal now. Okay.
Oh, yeah, because, you know, when
I met you, memoir. Come on, I'm joking.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, but you know, when I met you, you know, I was attracted to you when you were at Foxcroft, and I remember after the meeting, I was just concerned about your mental health because it seemed like everybody out there was white, and you was like a few black girls that were there, and I just was wondering that sort of isolation in your formative years, how that affected you mentally.
It was hard, you know. It was really hard. I think it's hard being the only thing, you know, one of the only people, you know. But I'll tell you what was harder than Foxcroft was Bennington, because there were only two of us. And
I won't mention the other name.
We're not going to mention the other person, but let's just say she could not look any more different than me. And yet people would walk up to me all day, every day, and say hey, and say her name, like good morning. And say,
do you
hey.
Remember? Do you remember your phone call to me?
Which like, one?
Yeah. No, you would like say Ethelbert, I'm up here. And every time someone acts up, you have to explain for the race what's going on. And then you said, I've got my own problems, and you're trying to write.
And then, do you remember? I don't know if I told you that I went to Lucy Greeley, the late great Lucy Greeley, who I actually went to study with at Bennington. She's the reason I applied to. I was so excited about applying to Bennington, Lucy, because I used to really confide in her. I mean, she was white, but she had a wonderful ear and was non-judgmental, you know. And so I had been talking about like how I could not stay in Vermont. And I was like, you know, everything is white. The snow is white. The walls are white. The towels are white. The people are white. The plates. I was like, I'm being swallowed by whiteness, you know, because coming from California, where like the buildings are all different colors and everything. And so one day she drove me into town. She parked in front of a house and she said, that's Jamaica Kincaid's house. And I said, oh, okay. And she says, you're going to get out and go and see her. And I was like, oh, okay. So I get out. I walk to Jamaica Kincaid's house. Now I'm scared because, you know, Jamaica Kincaid at that time, she had a reputation of, you know, being mercurial. And you never know
Right.
When she's going to be mercurial. So I was like, I'm about to knock on this woman's front door.
I always thought she reminded me of, Bessie Smith.
You know, and I'm already fragile, right? So I was like, uh-oh. So I go, ring her doorbell. I'm about to walk away thinking no one's there. Woo! John dodged that bullet. And then I hear her coming to the door, and then she opens the door and looks at me, and I went, I just need to see somebody Black. I just want to see somebody Black. It's all white people. And I was like, you know, it was as if I had escaped the sunken place. Oh my God. And so she looked at me and she said, come here, child. And she just embraced me and held me. It was just, and I wept, you know.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that story, because you also mentioned in your book that you've seen that you recommended sisterhood over therapy.
Did I say that I recommended it over therapy?
I'm reading closely of your book now.
Over therapy. I don't know if I said over therapy, but I do recommend sisterhood, because I think that, you know, I don't think I recommend one thing over another, because I think that if you need to take medicine, you should take medicine. I don't think, you know, I'm not somebody that's going to say drink some bleach. Mm-hmm. But so I think that sisterhood, particularly for Black women, mm-hmm. is important. Mm-hmm. I think we need to be there. We need to be part of a sisterhood. I think that we really heal each other. I think that we help each other, because we are so attacked in the United States. We are so under attack, and it is an everyday situation, and in ways that only another person who experiences that can understand. Mm-hmm. Only another person who experiences the level, being at that intersection of gender and racism, that misogynoir, as someone who understands that. And so being there for one another, I used to have a Black women's brunch, in my home, and we would just, gather, and it wasn't about the food. The food was actually in a different room. We would gather, and people would quietly get up and go get their plates if they wanted, but really it was about the communication. And one of the rules that, of the only rules that applied at the brunch, was that I didn't want people talking about their partners, because I didn't want it to be a gossip session about men or whatever. I didn't want to center men or, you know, partners, you know, not to sound heterosexist, but other people's partners. I wanted it to really be about healing and about our own issues and having those conversations. And what I thought would be, you know, once a month, a 2-hour brunch, it would start at 11 and it would often be like 10, 11 in the night, and people's husbands leaving messages saying, hey, I'm looking for my wife. She's been gone since morning, you know, and all of us still there, having now like finished the brunch food, ordered in from Chinese or something, you know.
And well, you know, when you say that, I look at how wonderful that is in terms of this sisterhood.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I saw that something, especially among African-American women, especially from like the 70s on up to the present. But then when I look at statistics, we know that, let's say, Black boys, there's a high suicide rate that sometimes we don't talk about. And I was wondering whether, you know, you see the need for Black men, and there's been different groups of Black men coming together, that would be just as important, that needs to be emphasized, that you need that sort of support among Black men talking to each other.
Yes. Absolutely. I think maybe even more important than Black women talking to each other, if I have to say that, partially because I think that Black men have to deconstruct this whole masculinity crap that they're, a lot of them, the machismo, the masculinity, that you're not a man if you this, or, you know, all these things that keep a lot of them from actually expressing what they feel inside. Mm-hmm. And I see wonderful examples of that lately on television shows. and on the internet where people are actually opening up and being really just vulnerable, you know, these Black men. And I just think it's wonderful. And I think it is important. The reason why a lot of Black men who were dealing with mental health issues that couldn't even talk about it, they couldn't even bring themselves to sully whatever their image was of masculinity by committing suicide. They had to do it with suicide by cop was what was happening, you know. So it wasn't even like, I'm going to go quietly somewhere and commit suicide. It was like, I'm going to do it this way. So I go out a certain way. I think that we need to change that entire conversation.
Talking about,
you know, Black male vulnerability. Yeah.
The other personal question I wanted you to address is the, I always see you moving around, you know, in terms of even some of your books that you put together in anthology. I'm looking at the immigrant, okay, the person who sometimes is torn between two cultures, going back and forth. I mean, you go to Africa, you come back to the state. How do you handle that in terms of going back and forth, but being torn between two cultures? I know there's some people, for example, may not speak, they may grow up here, may not speak the language. When they go back, they feel sort of marginalized. How does that affect the mental health?
Oh, wow. What I can say in terms of Ghana is that one of the aspects of my depression, seasonal affective disorder, is I don't suffer from it in Ghana, mainly because Ghana is almost at the equator. And so the sun doesn't really shift. So that's interesting in terms of from a biological perspective, a physical perspective. You know, I don't really know how to answer that question because the way that I was brought up, I didn't speak English in my house growing up. So I have always felt that this is home, you know. So there's always been that dividing line, which was the threshold of my front door growing up, where when I was on one side, it was Africa. When I was on the other side, it was America.
But you said something very important.
So I always traversed the two.
Right, but you said something very important, that in your household, the language was spoken. You know, yes. And I look at some of my friends who are Latino, where, okay, Spanish might be spoken in the house, okay? But then they're going to school in English. Now what happens many times, maybe it's back to school night, and sometime, okay, their parents who speak Spanish primarily, or now come to the school and they're looking like, okay, you know, sometimes the child is embarrassed by their parents because they don't speak fluent English, you know, and here's my teacher. And, and it's this torn between two worlds.
Yeah, you know, something that's interesting, something happened to me that has stayed with me my entire life, which was, I must've been like 9 or 10 years old. And, you know, Ghana was going through some difficult economic times. That was in the, I gotta tell my age now.
We're talking after Nkrumah.
That was not
that far back.
No, it was like 77. It was like 77. And which was a really amazing and pivotal year in my life because Roots came out, Jimmy Carter was elected.
Bicentennial. You know?
Exactly. Wasn't it also like the Queen's Silver Jubilee? Like was like right after or something. Anyway, so that's you know, we were a British colony. That was an important thing in our household. But my cousins, they would send like cardboard cutouts of their feet so that my grandma could buy shoes.
That's interesting.
So, you know, the shoe measurement device, she would put the cardboard on there, and then that way she could know what size to buy. And we went to Langley Park. We were living in Tacoma Park, Maryland. So we took the ride on bus to Langley Park, and we were at a shoe store there. And I mean, I worshiped my grandmother, and the way that this man spoke to my grandmother as though she were just nothing and spoke at a decibel that was like, she's not deaf. She just has an accent. You know, she's not deaf. She probably speaks English better than you. So spoke to her that way. And then I remember she gave him the cardboard cutout and he held it like it was contaminated. He held it like just at the very edge and was just being very dramatic about, you know, the measurement of it and everything. And I just felt this, I just felt both this shame, you know, but I also felt very like torn because I didn't want to be associated with whatever he thought was that contamination and that, you know, so it was like, oh, I'm American. Like I'm, you know, I'm not, I don't know how to explain it. It's like, it was that I just remember feeling very much as if somehow I had betrayed my grandmother.
Well, you know, talk about that. You talk about your grandmother and you talk about this loving relationship.
Yes.
Now this is the third question I wanted, which is personal. When you say that, I look at how you've been changing your name. Okay. I think that when you were at Foxworth, you might have been Mildred at one time. And then
I was Mildred in my youth. And yeah. I'd like to explain it to
Mildred and Mary and, you know.
Okay. Now see, here's the thing though, is that you say I've been changing my name, but I've not been changing my name. Mm-hmm. These are all my names.
Reclaiming your name. Or they're all your
names. Exactly. These are all my names. But let me explain. Let me put it into context. And I'm so glad you asked me because a lot of people just don't, you know. And so I was born like most Ghanaians and I had what's called a Christian name. Mm-hmm. So Mildred Mary was my Christian name. Also, like most Ghanaians, I was never called that. What happened to me was I moved to the U.S. when I was six. The colonizers, the missionaries, they required that African children have Christian names to go to school. So everybody was called out of their name, essentially, in order to attend school. Mm-hmm. So for me, though, that wasn't the case. I moved to America, but still, because I moved to America and my family thought my name would be too hard for people to pronounce, right? They thought, oh, Nanama is too difficult for people to pronounce. Let's use Mildred. And so that was my Mildred Mary. That's on my birth certificate. Mildred Mary Nanama Boachua Dankwa Brobi. So I was called Mildred, which I think is just the worst, most horrible, most terrible name. And I wore it so uncomfortably, one, because I just didn't like the name. And then two, because I hadn't been called that. And it was like, suddenly you're given a name and it's not a name that you care for. Now, I will say that every time I complained to my parents about how much I hated the name, my mother would remind me that my father chose that name and that she had been given a choice of two names, Mildred being one and Scholastica being the other. And her whole thing was, you better be glad that you're Mildred.
the question I asked after all this, what is your nickname?
You could be Scholastica, right?
You never had a nickname.
Never had a nickname. I'm not a nickname kind of person.
But so, you know, sometimes your friends give you a nickname. Did that ever happen?
Yeah, my friends didn't. But then, you know, the kids at school were awful. They called me Mildew and, you know, all kind of horrible stuff. But, you know, I was also teased because I had an accent and there was a lot of other stuff that was happening there. But when I got to be... When I got to boarding school, because I was leaving Tacoma Park, so all the people that I'd gone to elementary school with that called me Mildred wouldn't be around, I decided to start using another name. And so I used my middle name, which is Mary. Right. And that name was
M-E-R-I.
M-A-R-Y.
Oh, you changed it to M-A-R-I.
I changed the spelling because, you know, I am not religious. And I was like, we're not doing Mary Magdalene. We're not doing Mary, Mother of Jesus Christ. We are going to do our own little thing. So I changed the spelling and was Mary. But if you've noticed, there's nothing that you can ever find of mine that I certainly have authorized in print that didn't have Nanama in it. Mm-hmm. Everything that I've published, you would always see it's Mary Nanama Dankwa. And the reason why is that Nanama has always been the core of who I am.
Okay, and, well, my guest today is Nanama Dankwa. We're going to take a little break. Nanama Dankwa, I'm working on this, right? Okay, Nanama Dankwa is my guest out today on The Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller's show, and the station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
From Rahsaan Roland Kirk to Asada Shakur, WPFW has been your go-to for cultural and political education since 1977. Your contributions have allowed us to uphold the mission of liberatory media set forth by our founders. August 11th through the 24th presents another opportunity to support WPFW during our summer pledge drive. Donations can also be made anytime at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Going back on The Margin with my guest, Nanama Dankwa. You know, Nanama, I have to mention this, how important your book is. I was teaching a course, a memoir course at Goucher, and there was a Black woman that when we got to introducing you and we showed a video of you giving a talk, it was like, oh, I needed this book. You know, and to, you know, to be a teacher and see a student, and with this is a memoir class, because I never had any sort of preparation, you know, to really say, okay, I can now feel confident, have the courage to tell my story, you know, and I'm just asking for like 10 pages, you know, but, you know, just to get them to write something was, I think, but as soon as your book and also the fact that you, you know, we had a video of you talking. It was just so important to see somebody connect to a text. And so I wonder in terms of when you look back at your work and this book, do you feel in a small way maybe you saved a number of people's lives?
I don't think so. I don't think that I saved people's lives. I think that I serve as a mirror. And I think that mirror, that ability to be able to look into that mirror and to see yourself and to see that reflection is life-saving. And I think that's what literature does.
Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when you were on your book
tour. Literature does.
Right. I remember when you were on your book tour and promoting this book, I guess that's back in 1998. You also made sure, I think you had someone from the National Mental Health Association with you there. So yes. That if somebody asks a question, you could direct them to the expert as opposed to somebody saying, well, I read on page 52 that you use such and such medication. I'm going to use that, you know.
You know, I actually traveled with a therapist because I'm a writer. I'm not a therapist. I'm sharing my personal experience. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, would come up and say, you know, I've tried to commit suicide twice. You know, your book really helped. And then ask me for my phone number or for advice. And I just felt that, you know, these are waters that are dangerous for me to get into. If you want to ask me about metaphor or if you want to ask me about, you know, something literary, I can have that conversation with you, but a mental health conversation. So I had a therapist from the National Mental Health Association, and we also were set up to do screenings. Mm-hmm. And we were set up because the National Mental Health Association, which is now called Mental Health America, speaking of name changes, it's called Mental Health America. They have 50 offices in each state. They have an office in each state. And so wherever I went, they were set up to be able to give local resources, local assistance. And it was incredibly helpful for a lot of people and for me, because being with a therapist when you're on tour, even if her job is for the people who are showing up, is no small thing for you when you're also when you're also somebody who struggles with depression.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think about your book, Will It Wait For Me? And then I also think of Tony K. Bambara, the Salt Eaters, because that question in the beginning, are you sure, sweetheart, that you want to be well?
Yes, because being well is no trifling matter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tony K. Bambara is amazing. Just amazing. So you think about our books together, which mm-hmm. is just even saying that is such an honor. Thank you.
And then I have to think about you in terms of not just you, but you are a mother. And you talk about motherhood saving you. You know, I remember when your daughter was in the womb.
Yes. Yeah.
And mother, I know you're very proud of her. And talk about how she's doing.
Oh, Karama's doing well. She's a writer and she's an actress. And she's working in both fields. She's co-writing a YA novel right now. She was until the strike happened, which a lot of people post-strike, Hollywood is still trying to find its footing. But before the strike happened, she was a staff writer on Raven's Home, mm-hmm. which was a reboot of Raven Simone's show, That's So Raven. And then before that, she was a staff writer on the iCarly reboot.
Well, you know, I this is one of those shows that you just bring your daughter in. But I was wondering, did your daughter read your book? I know sometimes the children don't read the books. So she did. Did she give a critique of the book?
It was really hard for her. She read it during college. And there were a lot of things that I think were traumatizing. I think it probably sparked a depression in her to read the book.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. It was difficult for her. She didn't know about the sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. There was a lot that she didn't know about.
That's a lot.
But you know, she was in college. There was nothing I could do to stop her from reading the book. Nor would I have wanted to, you know? Yeah.
So when you say that, you know, was the book in the house? You know, it's like, okay, she's at college, you know, she could have been on a reading list or something, you know.
It's always been in the house. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I have multiple copies in the house, but
she didn't pick it up at that
time. It was just, oh, this is mom's book. Oh,
right,
mom.
Right.
But then to sit down and to read mom's book is something else, you know. I think that the assumption when you write a memoir is that people who know you feel that they know what you've written because they know your life.
Right.
And sometimes nothing could be further from the truth.
I totally agree with you. I've written two memoirs. I totally agree with you.
Yes. Yes.
One of which
I'm the ones who you were dedicated it to.
Oh, yeah. I dedicate. You know, I wouldn't even have a book if it wasn't for you.
Thank you for saying that.
Yeah. But let's talk about, and this is very important for those of us who are writers. Talk about how you handle depression, being a writer, meeting deadlines, you know, rejection, money issues.
You know what? Let's talk about the money issues, because I believe that the money issues, the issues that pushed me are what really made me a professional writer in the sense that I was a working writer. I wouldn't say they're what made me a writer, because there are people who write and never publish. You know, that doesn't mean that you're not a writer. But in terms of having the courage to ask for work, mm-hmm. because what I don't discuss, not in this book at the time, I couldn't discuss it, was that I was undocumented, which is a whole other conversation, but it was, you know, one of my family didn't follow up on their due diligence, basically. And so I slipped through the cracks, and I was the only one in my family, but I was undocumented. And that was most of all of my 20s and pretty much all of my 30s. I was undocumented. And so I couldn't work. And the more the immigration laws were changing, the more difficult it was for me to go out and get a traditional job. So writing was what I could do, and it was all I could do legally. And so I really, you know, got over, oh, am I good enough? I don't know. And I'd be like, you know, I was just trying to get work, you know. When Jeff Morley, who's an editor for The Washington Post, when he approached me, and actually he's the one that's responsible really for my book in terms of the chain of activities that led to the book contract. When he approached me after a poetry reading in DC and said, I really like your work. Do you write prose? I said, yes. I mean, he introduced himself as an editor from the Washington Post. And he says, I really like your work. Do you write prose? And I said, yes. But I didn't write prose. I didn't write any prose, you know, not since like my high school journalism class. And so I thought, well, I'm going to learn how to write prose, you know? And so that's really fascinating because now I'm like a nonfiction prose writer. And I mean, I'm writing more poetry lately, but the fact that I didn't, I know, right? But the fact that I started out as a poet, and it was only because somebody asked me, you know, because I knew he was going to ask me for work. Mm-hmm. And why am I going to say no? You know, I need the work. So it really, that's what really made me a working writer in my mind. In terms of deadlines, being a single mother, mm-hmm. that taught me to write in spurts. You know, I would write when I was, you know, waiting for the laundry to finish. I would write when, you know, just a little, I would take my notebook and I would write when I was like waiting for her to finish after school, or, you know, her after school program that she was in.
When you say that, you know, it reminds me of like how this you're part of this almost like a tradition, because I'm thinking of June Jordan. I'm thinking at one time Alice Walker. They were all like single moms, mm-hmm. you know, and Sasaki Shange at one time, you know, just having, mm-hmm. and I just the pressure for that. But then I also find out it's interesting that for many of those women who had, especially daughters, their daughters became writers.
Isn't that interesting? That I never thought that my daughter would become a writer, you know, but yeah. So, you know, I would write when I could. And, you know, it's like when I can do it is when I do it. Hmm. And I would make my deadlines. Sometimes I'd stay up all night. I pulled all nighters because my daughter was asleep. Things that I don't do now. Now it's like, oof, they're gonna have to give me an extension.
but there is something that you do that when I think about you, it's just another talent and another contribution that you've made. And I think of you like all along with like someone like Kwame Doors. You have been at the center of things like putting together anthologies, you know, looking at younger, not just African writers, but, you know, of other backgrounds. And mm-hmm. I always felt that was where you were looking at the new America, you know, yeah. you're looking at the new immigrants. Talk yeah. about how you maintain those connections, that network. Are you always looking for projects that will bring people in?
You know, I think it is in my nature, but I don't really, I'm trying to write my own work right yeah. now. Working on anthologies, because they were primarily administrative, really helped me stay in the flow of publishing while I was parenting. And also one way that I was making money was by ghostwriting. And so that made it difficult to write my own work all the time and to really engage in the business of publishing and, you know, just doing all the things that writers do, going to places like Yaddo, you know. And so I was able to sort of keep in the loop with anthologies. And I also love a good anthology, mm-hmm. you know. just seeing a subject from all these different perspectives, you know, reading just, I mean, I know that now people like short story collections, people like essay collections, but 20 years ago, wow, getting one of those published was so hard. And I never understood why, because I thought this is brilliant. You can read one piece, put it away, read another piece, you know, but people just didn't really, I mean, I guess they didn't make as much money as other books. But I really love when there's a subject matter and you get to see all these different perspectives and hear all these different experiences. I love anthologies and I would love to do more. And I think that my agent's probably going to listen to this and cry.
Well, let's talk about something, which we're moving towards the last few minutes of our show. So, but there's something that I always admire and respect you for. You know, when you say Dankwa, that name resonates. And talk about your grandfather, J.B. Dankwa.
My grandfather was one of the founding fathers of Ghana. He was a really incredible man. He was a theologian. He wrote a very important...
And you say you're not religious.
Not at all. He wrote a very important seminal work called The Akan Doctrine of God. He is the person who gave Ghana its name, Ghana. He also helped to found the University of Ghana. He's the one that convinced the powers that be to set it up in Ghana when it was being decided which of the colonial territories it would be set up in. He personally invited Kwame Nkrumah to come and work with the independence movement. And then he died a political prisoner because he opposed some of Nkrumah's more dictatorial tendencies. And so he died in political prison. But yeah, he was a lawyer. He was a writer.
I knew he was a writer because someone stole a copy of his book out of my African American Resource Center when I was at Howard. Never brought that book back.
But also, I'm really enjoying, lately I've been reading about him in Black Rage. Richard Wright goes to Ghana and writes about his encounters with Dr. Dankwa, and I find it fascinating. Mm. But the whole family is really fascinating. You know, it's a pretty incredible family. It's a family.
What is your relationship to Maya Angelou? I always was curious about that. Was she like a close family?
Maya Angelou was my unofficial godmother because Maya Angelou was my Uncle Paul's really good friend. And so when I was really young, we sort of adopted each other. And so she was my unofficial godmother.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, as we come to this end of this show, is there something that you mentioned in the afterword? And that's the whole thing about the biggest struggle in your life has been with silence.
Yes.
We've been laughing and talking for about an hour now, but talk about the silence that you've been wrestling with.
You know, there's a lot of, I think breaking silence is difficult, you know. There are things that people know that, you know, is acceptable to say. And so people will say those things. But then when you come out and say things that are unpopular or, you know, things that are, you know, unacceptable, you know, for society or for whatever, then people just kind of like, you know, they kind of silence you, you know. One of the things, for instance, that I've been writing about lately is I've been writing about estrangement, particularly mothers and daughters, you know, and that's a subject that a lot of people, you know, people are like, oh, but, you know, that's your mom. And, you know, people get very Hallmark about, you know, like the Hallmark greeting card idea of parenting and parenthood and all of that. But that's what I mean when I say my struggle against silence, you know, when we talk about sexual abuse or sexual you know, just the things that people don't want to talk about. But there are things that happen to a lot of us, and there are things that I think we need to talk about. We need to open these spaces, because once we do, they will free us. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are suffering.
You know,
and
you talk
a lot
about
of people are suffering because of silence, not necessarily just because of what's happened to them, mm-hmm. but because of the silence that is then imposed upon them. So what happens is that you're abused once, and then you're abused again by being silenced.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah.
And this is very important, and it changes the tone of our conversation. And as we move towards the end of our program, talk about self-care, because you talk about removing yourself from people who cause you harm emotionally and physically.
Yes. Well, we all know who those people are. I mean, there's even a
word, we all know who those
frenemy.
People are.
Like, there's a word that's like frenemy, right? We all know who those people are in our lives. Those people who, for some reason, you're around them, but you don't particularly like them. And they're not particularly nice to you, or, you know, we just people you tolerate, but somehow are in relationship with. And a lot of them are family members. And my whole thing when it comes to the family tree is to prune, you know. Oh, I'm being really serious, right? Because, you know, who is Philip Larkin?
Doesn't
he have a poem? they mess you up, your mom and dad, except that's not the word he used.
Right. That's exactly right.
So, you know, I think that we need to know when it's no longer just, you know, they're fussy or they're whatever, but when it's really actually abusive, when it's keeping you from flourishing. Mm-hmm. When it's something that is really sort of attacking your self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And only you know that. I mean, I don't know what that line is for somebody else. I know what that line is for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people should take care of themselves by removing those people. Mm-hmm. And that's easier said than done. Right.
Talk about how important it is to have your space. I mean, are you a person with, you know, plants and flowers? Do you have a, you know, like a cat or a dog? I mean, some people say, okay, I want to have a space that is home, that is warm, that is nurturing.
I think it is important. And there's a wonderful book by Elaine de Bottom. It's called The Architecture of Happiness. And it talks about space and mental health and happiness and the importance of that, the importance of having a space that you can really exist in. I believe we all learned that lesson, or at least got a taste of that with COVID and the lockdowns that happened. I believe that a lot of people started rethinking the spaces that they were living in.
And probably dealing with issues of mental health during that period also.
During the lockdown, yes, yeah. Because there were people who had these fabulous spaces, but they were just coming and going, and they weren't really living in those spaces.
How did you navigate through the pandemic?
Oh, I was great.
Okay.
I was great. You know, when it comes to times like that, mm-hmm. I believe that people who understand long-term illness and who already know how to
cope.
Basically, you know, be proactive,
right.
Do well during those times, because, you know, a lot of people were scared to be by themselves. I know that feeling, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people, you know, they stayed at home with their family and realized they didn't like them very much. There were a lot of divorces.
Mm-hmm.
People were really upset about their kids being home because they didn't like their kids that much. Mm-hmm. They wanted them back in school. People didn't like where they were living. You know, a lot of people realized they didn't like the lives they were leading.
Mm-hmm.
So that lets me know that a lot of people really hadn't investigated their lives. They were just kind of going by rote.
Mm-hmm. Well, the last question. I mean, okay. We're talking, and you're in Portugal. Are you coming home?
Am I coming home?
Yes. You're I'll Portugal answer right
that.
There.
I'll answer that question with a question.
Where is home? I knew you were going to say that. Okay. No, I'm just so happy that you took time to be my guest. I think Willow Week for
Thank
me.
Thank you.
This book, Willow Week for me, is a classic. And I'm
I love you, Ethelbert.
Well, I love
Since
you, man.
Since the age
too.
Of 14, I've loved you.
Since the age of 14.
Okay. That's when we met. I was 14.
Right. And I was your commencement speaker.
At Bennington, you
at
were.
At Bennington, right.
I wasn't 14 then.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Okay. Many blessings. My guest today is Nana Amadankwa. She's the author of Willow Week for Me, A Black Woman's Journey Through Depression. The show's on the margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
WPFW is looking for volunteers to answer phones and enter donor information during our summer membership drive beginning August 11th through August 24th. Phone volunteering is a fun way of meeting new people and possibly your favorite programmers while also supporting the station. Need community service hours? Phone volunteering is the perfect solution. Contact us at volunteers@wpfw.org or leave a voice message at 202-588-0999, extension 1008. That's volunteers@wpfw.org or 202-588-0999, extension 1008. For additional information, WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time. From Rahsaan Roland Kirk to Asada Shakur, WPFW has been your go-to for cultural and political education since 1977. Your contributions have allowed us to uphold the mission of liberatory media set forth by our founders. August 11th through the 24th presents another opportunity to support WPFW during our summer pledge drive. Donations can also be made anytime at wpfwfm.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The 20th anniversary of DC Jazz Fest happens August 28th through September 1st, featuring performances by Samara Joy, Jacob Collier, Stanley Clark, Emmett Cohen, Ron Carter, Diane Reeves, and more. Details at dcjazzfest.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Shalimar, War and Too Short. Come to Bethesda Theater in the month of August. More information at BethesdaTheater.com.
Oh yeah. Hey friends, we're back again. Mark your calendars. On Saturday, August the 24th, WPFW will host the 15th annual Blues Festival featuring Clarence the Blues Man Turner, Jim Bennett with Jesse Terrell, Stacy Brooks, Low Rent Quartet, Reggie Right Eye, and the Missing Pieces, all at Lamont's Entertainment Complex, 4400 Livingston Road in Indian Head, Maryland. Event time is from 12 p.m. to 6 p.m. For more information, go to eventbrite.com and search WPFW. Why, you ask? Because WPFW is building a better world, one broadcast at a time. Believe that.
Brazilian music is back in its righteous place on WPFW. I'm your host, Roberto, and Berimbau airs on Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. Are you ready to take a trip from Rio Grande do Sul to Amazon and back? That's Berimbau, Sundays, 8 to 10 p.m. on WPFW. Building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Dab returns to WPFW beginning Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. till 5 a.m. with music memories, the best of old school from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Yes, the return of Alvin Nedab on 89.3 WPFW FM, Monday, July 29th, 2 a.m. to 5 a.m. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Renee Bowser, a staunch trade unionist